Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is lecturer, producer, and writer Robert Philip. And we're talking about his latest book, A Little History of Music. Robert, welcome to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, this is part of, this is part of a series, a Little History series, right?
Yes, yes.
Still.
Yes, it all started with E.H. Gombrich, the art historian. He wrote a little history of the world back in the 1930s in Vienna when he was a research student. And that was a tremendous success in German. And he came to, like so many others, he came and settled in England. And he always said he would translate it into English one day, and he never got around to it. And then after his death, his assistant finished translating it, and it was published by Yale University Press, and it was fantastic success here. This was in 2000 or so. And so it was such a success, they decided to hang a series on it, getting others to write a little history of each subject.
I have to ask you about this. Okay. Mm-hmm. Did you volunteer or were you drafted?
Well, it was a kind of mixture because I was helping one of the editors at Yale with another project, and the idea came up for A Little History of Music. And she said to me, would you be interested in putting in a proposal for this? And I absolutely leapt at the task because...
Oh, my God!
It was exactly the sort of thing I would love to do, to try and broaden my horizons and just bring everything into one book. So I put in a proposal and made one or two adjustments to satisfy all the board and all that sort of thing. And they accepted it. And the great thing was that I was contracted to do it in August 2020, which was just before the horrendous winter we had with COVID and the lockdowns. And it was the perfect lockdown.
Oh, you're right. I could see that. Still, this project seems dauntless. I mean, all of music history, not only in just one volume, in one small volume.
Yes.
Oh, my God, my mind would boggle. You must have had page limitations.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's the series is rough for people who don't know much.
So, Robert, did you storyboard the history? And I want to mention, this is not just the history of Western music. It's the world history of music.
Yes, yes. Well, I took a very sort of informal way of trying to research it. I basically, I was brought up knowing about classical music and classical Western music and not very much else. I knew a little bit about jazz and popular music, but classical music was my starting point, like so many others have been formally trained in music. And I decided that I needed to learn as much as possible about all these other cultures of music through the centuries and across the world. And I simply trawled through the internet for things like conference papers, abstracts of conference papers, and just started to amass material about all these different subjects. And by going to the latest conferences, I also got a handle on what the latest thinking was about all these subjects and who was writing about them and what sort of line would be a good line to take on each of these subjects. So I over a period of about a year, I gathered all this material and just got an idea from that how to begin to structure the book. So it was a gradual process.
Wow. What are the earliest known musical instruments?
I think the earliest, well, it depends what you mean by a musical instrument, but I think the earliest things you can really call a musical instrument, there are flutes made from the bones of birds, the bones of mammoths, for I think about 40,000 years old. There were some found in Germany that you can't play them because they're not complete, but they're clearly flutes with holes in the right positions to produce an identifiable musical scale. And then in China, the I forget again how old they are.
I think it's 9,000 to 8,000 years old.
9,000 to 8,000 years old. There are flutes that you can still play, and that's extraordinary.
Do we know this music that the earliest instruments are playing? Do we know how it was used within those cultures?
Well, anthropologists have various theories about this, as they do about a lot of ancient sources. And, I mean, they try to put together various bits of evidence where these flutes were buried. For example, one of these flutes in Germany was buried in the same cave, or found in the same cave, as one of the earliest little Venus figures, which are thought to have been to do with the worship of fertility and fertility goddesses and so on. And the flutes are in close proximity to one of these figures. And so possibly they had some ritual purpose, but nobody really knows. Of course, there are ancient things like ancient cave paintings, people dancing, and some of them show somebody holding what might be a tambourine or something like that as people dance. So people put together all these different bits of ancient evidence and try and get some idea on how music was used. But, of course, it's all theoretical, and we can't really know.
Well, let's talk about classical Greece. There's a musical instrument that shows up in a lot of amphora and other ceramics. It's the double allos, A-U-L-O-S. Yes. I've never understood how they play that.
It was a reed instrument. I mean, you had single ones and double ones.
Yeah, the double one looks like they're sticking two flutes simultaneously in their mouth.
Exactly, yes.
They are?
Yeah, they are, and they're blowing them, and they're reeds, so they would produce a noise, you might say, akin to a bagpipe, which has two sounds. It has the drone that produces a constant note, and it has the chanter, the pipe with which you play the melody. And probably in ancient Greece, it was a similar thing. One of the pipes would probably just be playing a single note or maybe one or two notes, and the other one would be concentrated on producing the melody. And these are quite loud instruments, so they were used for dancing and outdoor activities and that sort of thing.
Now, as you write in the book, when people read Homer's epics, the Homeric epics, few people realize that people weren't reading them back then. These were performances that most likely were also accompanied by music.
Yes. I mean, there are references in a number of the ancient works of, well, what we now think of as literature. They were clearly from an oral tradition. We talk about Homer as if he was an individual, but people these days think it was basically a bringing together of various stories that had been passed down through the centuries and amassed and passed on by oral tradition long before they were written down. And there are references in the Iliad and the Odyssey to the bard singing a poem, and this was the way they were usually performed to an audience. They were not just spoken as we speak modern poetry. And this tradition went on for centuries, and many countries have a tradition of singing poetry. Of course, we still have singing of poetry in all sorts of contexts.
Now, we're going to skip around. There's so much information in this book. Yeah. I'm just going to follow a couple of the different threads. Talk to me about Christianity's effect on European music. And one of the things you write about is the regularization of chants.
Mm.
That they were, yes. The church controlled the way chants were being sung.
Yes, this is a very interesting area, I think, because when the Christian church first started becoming established, and particularly when it took root in Rome and there was so to speak, ruled from Rome across a wide area, there were all sorts of ways in which the church authorities wished to control how people worshipped, the form of service that they had, the sort of music that was being sung. And the chants that had started off as sort of variants of the Jewish chants from which Jesus and his disciples would have known, these gradually became adapted to a sort of repertoire of chants setting the Christian holy texts. And the authorities wished to make sure that these were controlled and didn't undergo too many variations in different places and from generation to generation, so they still remained identifiably what they thought of as Christian worship rather than some variant of it. And this was very difficult to control, of course, until notation came along, because Christianity obviously was established long before Western notation developed, which only started developing, was it, sort of 9th century or thereabouts. So you had 9 centuries of trying to control all this activity. But then when notation came in, of course, they were able to write down the chants and establish more clearly how the chants were sung. So you had copies of the chants being sent out to different countries of the Christian realm, and people were instructed to sing them according to what was sent out from Rome. And they sent out emissaries from Rome to teach people how to chant according to the Roman way. I mean, of course, all of this suggests something very strict, but actually, in the days when people weren't used to our sort of notion of reading a score with precise accuracy, I think the general understanding is that it was not as strict as all that. For example, there are suggestions in the early manuscripts when notation first started coming in, and the sort of predecessors of notation, so-called neumes, which were just little marks over the text to suggest how the chant might go,
like high or low.
Yes, exactly, that sort of thing. That indicated when the chant went up, went down,
okay.
And that sort of in relation to the Latin text. But there are also indications in there of when a singer might sing what were called flowers, or they might have vibrated notes. And it's clear that there was some sort of ornamenting of the chant was going on. And I think one can still get an idea of that if you hear how Greek Orthodox and other Eastern Orthodox churches still chant with quite a bit of sort of flourishes in the chant of a kind that are strictly kept under control in the more Western chant. They still allow these little flourishes, and I think that gives us an idea of what probably the early church chant sounded like.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is lecturer, producer, and writer Robert Philip, and we're talking about his latest book, A Little History of Music. I want to stay with the evolution of notation. You write about in the book about how important notation was. It was easier to control what was being sung, but it also made it possible to develop ever more complex methods of composing music. And that changed the course of music history.
Absolutely. I mean, it's important to say that many different cultures across the world do have music notation of some kind or another, and have done for hundreds, in some cases thousands of years. But the sort of notation that has tended to be used in most cultures is a fairly simple notation which enables you just to write down, say, a melody that somebody has composed. And nothing much else. And the purpose of having these melodies written down is so that you then have a basis on which to improvise, because in a lot of cultures, improvisation is how you develop from the little composition that you've got. And that is the entire basis of how the music goes in performance. What happened in Europe, first of all, and in the wider Western world eventually, was that the notation became so sophisticated and so precise that people were able to construct on the page elaborate music far beyond what you could possibly have developed simply by ear. And you first start getting this in the sort of polyphony, the sort of multi-voice church music that you get back in medieval times. And gradually you get, you know, 2, 3, 4 more voices being written for in parallel, playing, weaving counterpoints in so that the different voices fit together harmoniously in a very complex sort of way. And this developed extraordinary sophistication by the 14th, 15th centuries. So music started becoming something that was written down and then performed, rather than made up by ear and then performed. There were limitations to that. I mean, Josquin des Prez, around 1500, he was one of the most famous writers of this sort of counterpoint, working in Italy. He developed these very sophisticated ways of writing. But when he taught his pupils, he would say to his pupils that the first thing they had to do was to learn to improvise a part against a chant. So he would give them one of the traditional chants, and they would have to improvise another part against it so that it would harmonize nicely with the other part. And he said, this is an absolutely basic technique and skill that a composer should learn before they start writing music. And he said that any composer who tries to write music without having this basic skill is like somebody trying to fly without wings.
Scores also mean that the composer can be identified.
Yes, that's right, that's right. Because, of course, in many cultures and certainly in the early days of the European music and the early Christian chanting and so on, most of the chants are anonymous. I mean, there are one or two famous names that crop up around the time that notation is first getting going. Hildegard of Bingen, of course, is a very famous example. A remarkable figure, not only because she wrote these wonderfully sophisticated pieces that were written down, but also because she was an abbess of enormous power. She wielded extraordinary authority and was able to sort of challenge the male church authorities about how her abbey was run. Mostly composers were anonymous at that stage, and it's only really around 12th, 13th century you start getting names routinely attached to melodies.
The first printed score, as you write about in the book, 1501, was turned out by the Venetian printer Ottaviano Petrucci.
Oh yes, yes. Wasn't the
what did they look? What did it look like?
His printing is extremely sophisticated and beautiful. He wasn't the first to print, but he was the first to print very elaborate scores, sets of scores. And in those days, it wasn't like a modern score in which you had, for example, if you had a piece for four voices. These days, they would be printed with the parts one on top of each other, so you can see the progression of the chords and so on, all at once. But in his printings, each part was written separately. So you would have, one part on the left-hand page, and if there was room, there was another one underneath it. Then the next part was on the top of the next page, and the fourth part underneath that. So you couldn't just read the page and see what the four parts were all together. You had to basically get together and sing each part together before you actually heard what it all sounded like together.
When was the first keyboard instruments? They were what, clavichords and harpsichords?
Yes, it depends what you mean by a keyboard instrument, because there are very, very, even in ancient times, there are reports of sort of primitive organs, or at least simple organs, where you had levers which would let air into a pipe. But they weren't really sort of keyboard instruments. Then you did get I can't remember the dates, but certainly by sort of 1400 or so, you're getting organs with actual keys laid out in a keyboard, somewhat like we are used to now. And it gradually grew from there. You had organs with keys, like a modern keyboard, and then you had clavichords, which struck strings with a little tangent, harpsichords and others in the harpsichord family, where the string is just plucked with a little plectrum, all with a keyboard, pretty much like we're used to now.
What about the first orchestras?
Well, again, it depends what you mean by an orchestra.
Like a group of different musicians playing different instruments, playing together, playing the same score.
Yeah. When does that get going? I mean, anything that sort of resembles what we're used to now would describe as an orchestra, that really gets going in the 17th century. But long before that, you had what they called consort music, where you would have a group of instruments that would play together. In Elizabethan times, for example, in England, consorts of viols became very, very popular. Stringed instruments that would play together in groups of three, four, five. And in France, under Louis XIV and his predecessor, Louis XIII, there were groups of stringed instruments brought together, the violin family, which was just becoming widely available. So you'd have everything from sort of what we now think of as violins through violas, cellos, and a sort of double bass. And they produced a string orchestra. It was perhaps the first real orchestra back in the 17th century. And it developed, obviously, in the 18th century. You had the wind instruments, which first of all would have been sort of ceremonial or dance instruments, were brought together with these stringed instruments. So you gradually got the idea of what we think of as the orchestra developing from that.
Now, I'm going to go back in time, sort of skip back. We only have a few minutes left, but I have to say I was fascinated in your chapters about the minstrels, troubadours and goliards. Who were they?
Well, yes, I mean, there were all sorts of people that we think of vaguely as minstrels around Europe in medieval times. And most of the music that ordinary people would have known would have been music that was not written down at all. It was passed by ear. There were skilled musicians in every town, every city. There were groups of musicians who got together and made music. And this was a highly organized sector of musical society. Every year they used to have gatherings at which they would all come together to learn new tunes from each other. Again, in the days before things were written down very much, these were mostly illiterate people who just stored these in their memory.
Wow.
And a lot of these were also the best of these also were employed at court, even the royal courts. They would have minstrels there who would come and they would play music for dancing. They would play music for productions of plays, just to entertain the royal family and the courtiers and so on. So they were available to the whole range of society from the top to the bottom.
Now, did they travel or did they just stay put?
I think some of them traveled quite far. I don't know very much about all that. There were some, presumably, those who were employed at court stayed at court most of the time. But during the summer when they had these gatherings, they would presumably get leave to go off to get their new material.
I was going to say, so they were sort of charged with bringing in new stuff all the time.
Yeah, I think so. yes.
Now... do we know individual names of famous troubadours, minstrels?
There are names, yes, and some of the troubadours. These were figures in particularly in southern France. Some of whom were very well born. There were dukes and so on who were troubadours who were famous for singing and making up songs. They were a higher level of musician than the minstrels, some of them were very well known. I can't recall
okay.
the names just at this moment, but there were some who were, as I say, aristocracy who were known as troubadours, and some of their music survives in written down, not necessarily at the time that they composed them, but later on they were written down when notation became available.
Now we're almost out of time. We just have minutes left, and I want to ask you, I mean, this book goes all the way to contemporary times, which blows my mind that you were able to do that in a little volume. Was there one section that you just enjoyed writing about more than another?
Not really. I'll tell you what I really enjoyed doing was trying to understand the whole sweep of human history in music. Because musicologists have been, and ethnomusicologists have been arguing for a long time, how on earth do you bring together all the history of music and all its cultures in a way that actually treats everything fairly and with balance, but does not distort what was going on. And this is what I've tried to do in this book, in this miniature form. And I think I now understand the way these sort of waves of interaction between different cultures have gone on through the centuries, and how we arrive at what is a sort of modern melting pot of all these different influences. It makes one feel hopeful for the future that something might come out of all this.
Well, that's one of the things you write about early on in the book, is how music and instruments pass from one culture to the next. There's so much in this volume. I found it just a joy to read. It was really fun. My guest tonight has been lecturer, producer, and writer Robert Philip, and we've been talking about his latest book, A Little History of Music. And it is indeed a little book. It's a little history of music, but an awful lot is crammed in there. Robert, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.